This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents High Mage, Book 5 of the Spellmonger series, written by Terry Mancor, performed by John Lee. Prologue. Gavard Crossing, Northern Gilmora. The waters of the Poros River were swollen with the spring thaw, as we gingerly walked over the long plank that was the last functional remnant of Gavard Bridge. The river was wide and deep, but with the weight of the melting snows from the faraway Minden Range, the Poros was surging just a few feet shy of the bank. The plank under my boots was a comfortable 2 feet wide, but the rush of the water below, the sound of it angrily splashing against the bridge's footings, reminded me that one incautious step off the plank and it would be all over. With as much armor as I was wearing, I don't think even magic would have saved me from a watery doom. One misstep, and it was over. That summed up this whole situation. I make a point of paying attention to when the gods send me these little metaphors. The Grand Bridge itself wasn't destroyed. It was just inoperable. The wide section that used to be raised and lowered to permit barge traffic through had been allowed to fall into the river below. That wouldn't necessarily stop the massive column of goblins, trolls, siege worms, and assorted turncloak humans who had joined the dead god's armies. 150,000 of them, by Sir Festalin's estimate. The column was packed with siege equipment, the goblins' version of catapults, trebuchets, scorpions, and the like. There was a lot of heavy equipment there. But goblins don't like water. They had to take the bridge, and getting across one little bridge wouldn't be that difficult, even for the goblins' inept engineers. Trying to do that while 2,000 human and Alka-Alon archers were pouring arrows down on you, like a heavy rain, might prove challenging, however. That was the plan. The banks and townlands on the south side of the river had been heavily fortified in the last 2 weeks. Hastily constructed redoubts concealed vantage points that would allow hundreds of men to fire at the attackers from relative safety. Just behind them, a dozen catapults and other artillery were ready to lob rocks and spears at the foe, and amongst them all were scattered nearly 100 high magi, who had built a formidable defensive spellwork that would confound any attempt to cross the bridge. I was really hoping it would be enough. Goblins, Gervani, the short nocturnal humanoids who had gathered an army and invaded human lands, were strangers to the littoral arts. Humans love boats, and the riverlands allow relatively speedy travel and trade across three duchies. But goblins saw rivers as a place to drink. They didn't use boats, they didn't swim, and so far in our battles they had rarely tried to cross a river they couldn't wade comfortably. Goblins were land creatures, exclusively. That gave us an advantage. As the column that had burst forth from the Umbra a few weeks ago wound its way south, down the timber road, until it became the cotton road, it had avoided any large rivers along the way. They acted as convenient walls for the advancing army, funneling them toward a small number of possible destinations. We'd used that information to craft our defense. Gavard was strategically important because of that bridge. We'd destroyed nearly every other bridge crossing the Poros, save three, to limit their options. The goblins had chosen Gavard to cross the Poros, so that's where we set the thickest defense against them. And if our stout defenses at the bridge gave way, there were over 10,000 professional fighting men in the castle behind me, looming over us like a great circular wedding cake. As dusk fell, and the vanguard of the column approached the village on the other side of the river, unimaginably named Northbridge, a flag of truce and parley had been spotted by our scouts. After consideration, I had the responding ensign flown. I didn't know why Sherul's minions wanted to talk, but I was willing to satisfy my curiosity. I had chosen a special party to meet them, too. Rondol and Tyndall accompanied me as bodyguards, of course, their new mage blades and battle staves in hand, and a dangerous look in their young eyes. Lorcus insisted on coming, and I wasn't about to stop him. The Rumeran War Mage had become a valuable lieutenant and troubleshooter for me in the last few months, and I appreciated his insight. Commander Terlaman was with us too. My old army buddy from the Frisian campaign had matured perfectly into his role as Knight Commander of the Royal Magical Corps. He'd done a remarkable job, getting things organized in advance of this battle, working with the Warlord, Count Salgo, and the other mundane commanders. Acting as herald for our side was the indomitable Sire Kay, looking powerful in his new armor. Like mine, it had a breastplate made from the hide of the dragon he'd slain at Castle Cambrian. Unlike mine, the hide had also been used to protect his arms, legs, and groin. As the hide was not just ridiculously tough, but also fiendishly difficult to hook a spell into, it provided as much magical protection as mundane. In his hand he bore the royal standard. At his belt was the new warhammer I'd given him a few nights past, when Master Comoran had finally delivered it to me. That warhammer was special. Comoran and I had discussed its design and construction for nearly a year. The head was made from meteoric iron and other alloys, and the handle was specially designed, fabricated, and enchanted to be able to not just withstand the energy from Sire Kay's magical talent, but channel and amplify it without destroying the weapon or knocking Sire Kay off his feet. He had tested it all day yesterday, pulverizing boulders with a flick of his wrist. He had dubbed the weapon Thunderhead. Comoran had even crafted a dragon's head on each side of the head. Sire Kay looked every inch the dragon slayer. Near the end of the makeshift bridge, my foot slipped, ever so slightly. My warstaff automatically flew up to balance me. I was never in any real danger, but the jolt of adrenaline surged through me like a lightning bolt. The chaotic waters of the spring flood beckoned below. I took a deep breath and made the last few steps without incident, finally standing on solid stone, not ephemeral wood. Captain Arborne was there to greet me on the other side. The tall, serious-looking Kasari ranger had his bow out and strung, but no arrow knocked. The signature green-mottled cloak of his people was thrown back over his shoulder, exposing his business-like longsword and the raptor embroidered on his breast. Hundreds of his rangers had scoured the country north of the river in the days leading up to this one. Now they had mostly pulled back to positions south, or had settled into blinds in Northbridge to await the arrival of the enemy.
"Our guests have arrived, Spellmonger," he said in a low, husky voice.
His eyes flashed left and right as he checked on hidden signals his men had put into place.
"A party of 20, on horse, and hound, fell hound," he added, a curl to his lip.
The Kasari hated the giant mongrel dogs the dead god's priests had bred to his service as carnivorous cavalry. They had hunted the canine scouts relentlessly. The dogs were fearsome enemies, in addition to the damage their riders could do. "How far back are their reinforcements?" I asked, as the others crossed behind me.
"There is a unit of 600, a quarter mile back. A half mile up the road is another 2,000. Light cavalry and light infantry. The vanguard," he explained. "There are still miles of goblins behind it."
I nodded. I knew that. Better than he did. The column of angry Gervani and brutal trolls stretched out for 20 miles as it made its way south. On either side, roving bands of light infantry scoured the countryside for forage, loot, and to spy any resistance to their approach. At its center was a huge line of siege beasts, massive, six-legged creatures like giant armored worms with 15-foot spikes protruding from their noses. The goblins were using them as portable redoubts and draft animals. I hadn't seen them in battle yet, but they promised to be highly effective. Long trains of wagons and carts were towed behind each one, and they were all headed for this very spot. "And the flag of truce is still being displayed?" I asked.
"Aye, Spellmonger," the ranger captain agreed. "I have 30 men with arrows knocked, ready to draw and loose at the first sign of trouble. 100 more can be summoned with a horn call."
"The Gervani are not in the habit of breaking truces," I pointed out, "at least thus far. I hope they will not be needed. Yet." Arborne grinned and stepped in place behind me as we walked across the rest of the bridge toward our parley in Northbridge. The goblins' native notions of warfare were fairly primitive, before the dead god united their tribes in the purpose of slaying every human being on Kalador. But as they had fought against us, they had begun fighting more like us. Part of that was the influence of their human confederates, voluntary and not. Part of it was the Gavanni genius for adaptation. Their party, waiting for us in what had once been Northbridge's Market Square. It was smaller than the one we had passed through in Southbridge, more of a farmer's market for local produce than a full-fledged town market. It had once been prosperous. Now the hard-beaten dirt hosted a small pack of very large, bloodthirsty hounds. It was the first time I had seen the animals my apprentices had dubbed fell hounds, but I found their description apt. They were thrice the size of ordinary dogs, as large as a donkey or pony. But these beasts had a far wider stance than graceful equines. Their paws were as big as pie plates, their blackened claws stained with the dust of the countryside and other things. Their fur ranged from brown to grey to inky black, and their lolling tongues and wild eyes seemed to reach everywhere in their vicinity. Upon their backs clung riders, mostly smaller Gavanni scouts bearing javelins, short bows, bucklers, and long curved swords. They rode those beasts masterfully, if entirely unlike how a man would ride a horse. There seemed to be genuine affection for the goblins by the dogs, affection shared with a marked belligerence toward us humans. Among the dozens of dog-born scouts were a cluster of real horsemen. I noted the black banner one of them bore before I saw their figures through the twilight gloom. It was on a long and viciously barbed war lance, with a head of sharpened iron. The knight who carried it was a man, dressed in well-forged blackened armor, a mantle of sable on his shoulders. Even through the gloom and the armor I did not need to see his heraldry to tell who it was. Sire Coucy, former lord of Beauval Vale, now tormented lieutenant of the dead god. Despite his dreadful armor, he looked ghastly. The horrific burn scars he had gotten at Timberwatch had hardened into a slab of chaos that was only vaguely recognizable as human. But he bore himself as proudly as a duke on his big mount. Next to him on a painted destrier was a taller figure in light horseman's armor. A shield was strapped to his arm that told him out as the mercenary we knew as Butler. As far as I knew, this was the first time anyone had seen his face and survived. He had decidedly imperial features under his helmet, and the nastiest sneer I've ever seen on a human being. This was a man who held the world in contempt. I could see why he was working with the bad guys. I'm not certain if the good guys would ever have taken him. A third human lord stood in attendance of Coucy, bearing their truce banner, and there were a few more cavalry troopers milling around behind them. The rest were hound-mounted goblins. A few were clearly important, like the priest who accompanied them. He, more than Coucy, seemed to be in charge of their expedition. The Gervan had eschewed armor of any sort in favor of a long black robe with a pointed hood, almost like a monk's robe. He bore a twisted wooden staff in one lye-bleached paw. It pulsed with magic, and I was on my guard. Two more priests and a vicious-looking cavalry Gavan stood nearby, their mounts sprawled on the cool flags, panting while they waited. They looked impatient.
"Hail to the invaders to our land!" called Sire Kay, our herald. "Hail, defenders of Gilmora!" Sire Coucy answered, his voice deeper and more sonorous than I recalled. "Is that you, Sir Kay?" he asked in surprise. "Sire Kay, now my lord," my castellan informed his former employer stiffly. "You look," he said, trailing off as he searched for a diplomatic adjective. "Like the meat the cook burned for dinner," laughed Sire Coucy bitterly, as we came within a few yards of their party. "Thanks to the spellmonger, yet I am the fortunate one. Thousands were burned far worse than I." "Casualties of war," I shrugged. "It was a well-fought battle." Was he really trying to make me feel guilty for conjuring a fire elemental? "As will be today's," the mercenary I knew as Butler said sharply. "You hold that town?" he asked, gesturing and spitting. "Tenaciously, and the castle beyond," I agreed evenly, "nor am I likely to yield either one lightly."
"I would hope not," agreed the man. "Far more sporting that way."
"Your name, sir?" Sire Kay asked sharply.
Sire Ralun, Knight of the Penumbra, he said haughtily, in service to His Majesty, King Ashakal, direct descendant of Shirul the Old God.
Traitor to your kind, you mean, growled Sire Kay. You serve an inhuman beast who consumes human flesh, a puppet king of an evil tyrant, ruling over a conquered land with slaves for subjects.
One might say the same of your own monarch, Sire Raylan sneered.
I am as good a knight as you, sire, though I serve a different master,
the dark warrior said insistently. Perhaps we shall cross swords this day.
Then it will be your last time doing so, warned my castellan.
You know not whom you taunt, my dear Raylan, the goblin priest said in perfect Narasi. This is clearly Sire Kay, the dragon slayer, he who struck the fatal blow to the beast at Cambrian Castle.
I have that honor, acknowledged Kay stiffly. Despite being an ideal knight in many ways, Sire Kay was not comfortable with his new fame, particularly hearing of it from the mouths of his foes.
Then I doubly anticipate the fray, Sire Raylan laughed. Once we cross the river, look to your sword, my friend.
As to making that crossing, you may find yourself delayed, I suggested.
By that rabble, snorted Raylan, nodding toward the Kasari rangers skulking about behind us.
They are more formidable than they seem, the goblin priest assured him.
Those are Kasari, the ones who trouble us so in the north. Nor are they the only defense, Raylan. The place reeks of Humani magic.
And warriors, I added, warriors fighting to defend their homelands.
I care not why they fight, grunted Sire Raylan. They can die for whatever cause they wish, but die they will.
I have been placed in charge of the forces of the vanguard, Sire Kusi said, patiently, and it is indeed our intention to cross this river, Spellmonger.
And it is our intention to resist that action, I countered. If you are wise, you will turn around and head back into shadow.
We prefer to bring the shadow here, the priest said. I am Kagatag, priest to His Majesty Ashakal, devoted to the old god. Your ways are well known to us, mage. We know about your stolen shards of our lord's grace. We care not. Cast your puny spells. The power of the old god shall prevail.
Sire Kusi's eyes twinkled. This sort of volley of threats was a standard part of battle, and he enjoyed the ritual. I suppose he had to take his pleasures where he could find them these days.
It would be best if it was you, my lord Minolan, who were to lay down your arms. You could spare yourselves a great deal of bloodshed today.
We've been preparing for this for over a year, I countered. We'd be disappointed if we didn't at least try.
Then let us not disappoint you, Sire Kusi said in his rattling voice. That is all we came to demand. If you wish to defend, we will be obliged to attack and destroy you. Utterly.
Not tonight. You do not have the forces here yet to assault the bridge, Tyndall pointed out unhelpfully.
You have no idea what forces we have at our disposal,
Raylan the butler said mockingly.
Go back behind your river, cowards. The Gavanni have shown me true warfare, and by the old god's grace I shall give you a lesson in it.
He added something in Gavanni, to which the scouts responded by screaming war cries quickly echoed by their mounts. If the formalities are dispensed with, then, I said in a bored tone of voice, then I ask only that you allow us to return behind our lines before you begin your assault.
But of course, agreed Kusi. We are not uncivilized. The truce was fairly observed and fairly discharged. You may return to your lines across your plank, and we will refrain from firing for an additional 10 minutes. We would not want it said we attacked you before you were ready to receive us.
Stupid, Humani, preening,
snorted the Gervan in cavalry armor. Get gone and prepare to meet our blades. He showed his fangs in an effort to look fearsome. I glanced back over my shoulder at the raging Poros.
Not unless you brought a barrel to ride across on. But good luck with your assault, nonetheless. It is our honour to slaughter you.
That brought an amused, if ghastly, chuckle from Cusi and Raylan, but only scowls from the Gavanni. I guess you had to be human to appreciate it.
That went surprisingly well,
Arborne admitted, as he led us back across the plank. It was starting to get dark now, which didn't make the churning waters any less sinister below my feet. I cast a mage light, even though it might attract sniper fire. I wasn't about to accidentally fall in the river in the moments before a major battle. My pride couldn't take that.
I really didn't expect it to be much more than that, I agreed. Just a formality.
Why warn your foe, though?
Tyndall asked, shaking his head. We weren't just warning them we're here, I pointed out. We were able to make some determinations about their strategy from how they presented themselves, whether they're weak or strong.
Definitely strong, murmured Rondal, glancing back over his shoulder at the pacing hounds and pawing horses. Whether they will be attacking magically or mundanely?
Looked like both, actually,
Tyndall muttered, to an assenting nod from Lorcus.
And whether they might be able to be bought off,
I finished weakly.
No, I did not receive that impression, sire, Sire Kay informed me after a moment's reflection.
No, me neither,
Lorcus agreed.
In fact, they seemed quite resolute.
Determined, even,
agreed Arborne as he crossed the last bit of distance.
Impassioned, perhaps,
offered Telamon.
I think we've made quite enough observations, I decided quietly, as we passed by the crossbowmen reclined behind barricades. Yes, they're going to attack. Yes, we're going to defend. No, they're not going to cross this bridge, I added, a little more loudly, so that every man in earshot would hear it clearly.
We made our way back to the much larger side of town, to a tavern we'd pressed into service as a field headquarters. Luckily, not all the provisions had been carted away before the transition, and mulled wine was waiting for us when we arrived.
How many?
Wenek asked, huddling by the fire with a blanket over his shoulders. The war mage specialized in offensive magics. He was pretty offensive in his own right. Wenek lived for causing pain and suffering, death and dismemberment through artful expressions of magic. He was one of the many such talented high magi I'd called into service for this battle.
Just a few hundred for now, I answered, doffing my mantle, but thousands more coming. I don't see much point in them attacking us in force until they do, so we're probably just looking at skirmishes and sniper fire this evening. But tomorrow, and the next day, that's when that column will arrive in earnest. If they don't take this place before then that army is going to start backing up. Once it's stopped, we can summon reinforcements to attack them. There were 50,000 or 60,000 troops or more downriver from here, feudal levies from Wenshar and Rhymir under the ostensible command of the Prince Heir, Tavard. They could be summoned at any time, and move swiftly up the river to any of the three bridges that might have need of them. I didn't know much about the future King of Castalshar as a commander in the field, but Tavard was only a few years older than Tyndall, and I barely trusted him to empty my chamber pot. The reserves were there if we needed them. A big, long, relatively undefended column of goblins standing around patiently waiting for the bridge to open up sounded like a good place for them to go. The tavern was warm against the chill, with a fire and food in a kettle, and I honestly didn't expect there to be a major skirmish that night. While Cusi and the other commanders were here, they wouldn't do anything decisive until they got reinforcements too. Or so we thought. About an hour after I had settled into a chair by the fire, with a pipe and a cup, I got a message from Draenus, mind to mind. I'd left my court wizard back in the more comfortable and secure quarters at the castle, overseeing the scouting reports for me and scrying for details while I was in the field. Just the sort of useful work a court wizard does for his employer. Some of those reports had come back with interesting results.
There's some activity from the advanced scouts I thought you'd be interested in. They aren't advancing in force yet, but they are sending out scouting parties. The interesting thing is, they aren't focusing on the bridge. They're heading for the river, away from our defences,
he reported dutifully.
A party of 100, mounted on hounds. Mostly priests, he added.
Priests? I asked. That was interesting. What are they doing? Trying to build a magical bridge? Raising night sails?
That was an unsettling thought. Night sails would not have any trouble crossing the river. They would just float across. And then the gaseous-looking things? We still weren't certain if they were spells or creatures, though I favoured the latter theory. Would play havoc among our defenceless troops. That was a worrisome thought.
Let's hope not, but that might be it. It takes a while to summon those things, though.
I remembered my first encounter with them in the Penumbra last year, where it had taken both me and Azar to defeat just one of the insidious things. If that's what they're doing, we should have plenty of time to disrupt them, I think. Where did they set up?
That could be telling. We had some war magi hidden on the north side of the river for just that sort of thing.
They found a spot along the river near a hillock on the north side. They're doing something, a ritual. So far, the closest we can get is about a quarter mile.
What kind of something?
We don't know, but they've set up a camp and built a fire, and our scrying shows an increase in magical energy in the area.
Drainers. Just how many priests?
60? 70? Plus guards?
I thought madly. 60 or 70 priests was a lot. More than I had heard of assembled in one place at one time since the war began. It didn't take near that many to summon a night sail.
No, that didn't feel like what they were doing. While there was no guarantee that each of them had witch stones, if enough of them did, it was bound to be trouble. Actually, there was no way in which this was not going to be trouble. A disturbing thought occurred to me.
You think that they're building a bridge?
A magical bridge?
We've done that sort of thing before, I reminded him. They aren't stupid, merely unsophisticated.
Well, we do have contingencies for that, he agreed.
I'll handle it, I decided. I'll contact Telemann. He's commanding from the bridge. I ended my discussion with Drainus and opened one to my old comrade, who had excelled at running the magical core. Terl really was made for this sort of thing.
I'll have a few patrols converge on the spot, and I'll get a few of our pet Kasari try to get close enough to see what they're doing. Captain Arborn is with me now. Have a full war magic team assembled, too. I don't like it when that many Ghavani priests go off and be sneaky about it.
It does sound like a bridge, Telemann admitted a few moments later. The height of the hill would be perfect from that sort of...
Bide, I just got handed a report from the rangers. 2 units of Ghavani cavalry have ridden to support the encampment.
Not good, I agreed. They really are up to something. Get that team together and keep me posted.
It was frustrating, having to depend on other people like that. I really wanted to ride out there and see it for myself, but I couldn't do that sort of thing anymore. That's not what commanders did. They sent other men to do it and had to patiently wait and rely on other eyes. Power, they called it. I could order men to die and cause battles to happen without even leaving my chair. I sighed, debating whether to chance a nap. The tavern was quiet now as everyone tensely awaited the first volleys of arrows or howls of defiance from the Ghavani skirmishers. That's not to say they weren't out there. Our scouts were reporting more and more arriving every hour from the north. Yet apart from some advanced scouts, they hadn't tried to occupy Northbridge yet. In fact, they seemed to be avoiding the village altogether.
Strange.
We expected an attack that whole night. By midnight, I was getting very antsy. There were 2,000 goblins gathered half a mile downriver from Northbridge, but no rafts, no brave swimmers, no attempts to ford the river by even the most foolhardy goblins. Just this mystical conclave on the banks of the Poros.
It has to be a bridge, I blurted into Telemann's mind shortly after midnight.
I don't think so, he countered. I've been studying their deployment patterns. If they were building a bridge, I'd expect them to line up perpendicular to the banks. Another legion just arrived, and I expected them to fall in behind the first group, but they're lining up parallel.
That doesn't make sense.
I thought for a moment.
You're right.
It doesn't. Unless they're planning more than one bridge.
I don't like this, Tal.
Me either.
We don't have a contingency for that. What should we do? Do we have any troops in place to try their defences? Just a few Kasari. The legions are too strong for a cavalry patrol to contest. But the Kasari are all over that area. The problem is Captain Arborn isn't enthusiastic about using them as combat troops. They can fight. They can fight like demons. But their skill is in their scouting. He keeps insisting that they are not combat troops.
He's right. I agreed. No need to lose good men to test a theory. I've learned to trust the man's judgment. I've never seen a better scout, even among the Kasari. Besides, Pentandra is twitter-pated over him.
What?
Pentandra? Over Arborn? His mental voice conveyed astonishment.
Yeah, although that's privileged information. She just told me a while ago.
Strangest thing. Who knew tall, dark, handsome, strong, silent and virtuous were the keys to her heart?
That's terrible. He seems like such a nice guy. Now I feel sorry for the poor bastard.
Does he have any idea what he's in for? If Penny wants him?
Look, don't tell him,
I urged. I want it to be a surprise. And Penny will kill us both slowly if we say anything, I added.
A fair point, he conceded. Prissy Penny and the Scruffy Ranger. I won't be able to look at him with a straight face now.
Thanks.
I waited an hour and had just decided to grab a nap in a chair next to the fire when Terleman called to me again.
Min, wake up. Dispatches from the field. 4,000 Gavani Light Infantry and 2,000 Hound Cavalry have arrived at that damn encampment. I've alerted our forces on both sides of the river to be ready for anything.
So, have they attacked the bridge?
They're still ignoring the bridge. They're lining up along the riverbank. They've traded shots with our outposts and sentries, but mostly they're leaving our side of the river alone.
I'm worried, he confessed.
It's worrying, I soothed.
You have reinforcements in the area? About 1,000 horse, spread out over 6 or 7 miles. And the rangers. They're starting to pull back over the river now, though.
They're uneasy.
Why?
They can't tell me, but they feel it.
Damn savages.
Hey, the Kasari are an ancient people. They date their culture from the arrival of humanity from the void, not to mention an entirely literate people. Just because they live in sacred groves, practice animal totemism, and dress in homespun hemp cloth. Look, the Kasari are great. Perfect rangers, never met better. Decent fellows, everyone. It would just be nice to have some actual evidence to base troop movements on, and not just a bad feeling.
The Kasari are canny, Terl.
Look, I sympathize. I'm confused about this, too. But if they have a bad feeling, well, I'm inclined to share it. What in the name of Ishi's dewy mound are those bastards plotting?
We won't be able to fly birds overhead until morning. Scrying is being blocked. If the scouts pull out...
Another anxious hour passed. More goblins arrived to crowd the bank along the northern side of the Poros. Their bows were just able to shoot over the wide river. Ours had better distance. We taught them to keep shy of the bank, but other than that, there was little fighting.
Terleman called again.
Our war magic team is finally in place. 4 men. They're going in now.
He told me their names.
I knew 2 of them. Time was when I knew every high mage by sight.
No more.
That was a good thing, I reminded myself. All 4 were outstanding candidates, or else they wouldn't have been chosen. The shamans are preparing a spell, he informed me 20 minutes later.
Well, I didn't think they were planning Princess Radine's bridal shower.
What kind of spell?
A bridge of some sort?
Whatever it is, there's a lot of energy involved. Report says that even with the Irionite on the ground, they're getting power imported from elsewhere.
Sherul? Directly?
It would make sense.
Shit, Min. Now I have a really bad feeling about this.
Is the team in a position to disrupt the spell at all?
No,
he answered after a moment's silence. The shamans are well guarded. A whole pack of those god's damned dogs. And light infantry. Anything they did would get them more attention than they would be comfortable with.
I don't blame them, I replied,
glad that Terleman wasn't the sort of commander who saw his men as expendable.
What about the siege engines? Could a trebuchet reach there?
I don't know, Min, and I don't think...
Wait. Bide a moment.
Ah, I said into the darkness.
Several excruciating moments later, Telemann returned. Min, you should put on your armor. You need to get up here. I'm still wearing it. To the castle.
Why?
Ah, actually, go look at the river. You're close to it. Go look at it. Apparently the priests just attacked it. Attacked the river, not the bridge. That's what the report says. I need you to confirm it. Can you get down there? I need eyes I can trust, and right now I'm getting a lot of shock and confusion. I'm on it, I agreed, and reached for Blizzard. I ran the length of the road, through two checkpoints, until I got to the base of the broad stone bridge. Something had changed. I could sense it. There was an awful lot of magic that had just been released, and that had done something else, I knew, although as I ran I could not figure out what. I gazed down into the river bend, suddenly realizing what was missing. The sound of the river moving by. There was nothing. I peered down into the pores. There was no constant twinkle of splashing a river makes, nor the sparkle of starlight from the surface. There was nothing. With a sharp and painful horror, I realized what they were doing now. Something that shredded each and every single one of our well-thought contingency plans. They had, with one spell, rendered our entire defense of Gilmora utterly moot. The bastards. I headed back to the castle at a dead run.
Tell, mobilize the troops. Everyone back to the castle. Withdraw from the bridge, defensive positions, pull in the patrols. Get everyone off the road. Close up the castle, prepare for siege.
Ishi's titsmen! What the hell's is happening? You want me to abandon the bridge?
The bridge is pointless now. Get everyone back. Now. I explained why. It only took a single sentence.
Holy shit, men, he replied in awe. How did they?
Who knows how? They did it. That's the important thing. All of our plans are in the chamber pot now. You understand what this does to our defense?
Shit.
Yes. I'll be back at the castle. In a few minutes. We won't have long after that. Get someone to use the mirror to contact the king at Castabriel. Let him know what happened. Even he will be able to see what this means.
The king.
Yes. I suppose he needs to know. He is the one in power.
The power?
I asked, humorlessly chuckling.
Power is a joke, my friend. He doesn't have any more power right now than I do.
Shit. Do you realize what this means for our reinforcements?
Durin's axe. What should I tell Rad, then?
Tell him the truth, I said, as I burst into the tavern to gather up my startled men before heading back to the wedding cake castle. I could already hear the orders to fall back being bellowed into the night behind me.
Tell him we're screwed. This time next week, the goblins could be using his palace as their new dining hall. If they don't decide to unleash the dragons on it first.
Chapter 1. The Spellmonger's Marbles. Sevendor Castle, Year 2 of King Rad's Reign. A year before that battle, I was reflecting on the nature of power. Power was not everything I dreamed of. Mostly it was boring and made my ass hurt. I was in the Great Hall of Sevendor Castle when I first made that observation to myself a year before the Battle of Gavard. The dingy white walls of the castle had been recently scrubbed, and the tapestries had been beaten, fresh rushes scattered on the hall's floor, though I was considering having the place tiled, as was becoming fashionable, in preparation for this very event, my spring court. Not the criminal court, which was thankfully lean at the moment, but the civil court. It was obligatory as Lord of the Domain, and while the chore could theoretically be deferred to my castellan, Sir Kay, his mind was elsewhere, on the belly of his pregnant wife, who was due for delivery in a moon or less. He was already involved in the management of my estates, and asking him to take on this task in addition would be doing us both a disservice. Nor was he an ideal judge, as this was not merely the normal business of Sevendor Domain. I had 5 new domains I was responsible for now. Each one seemed to be brimming over with problems and festering feuds that absolutely required the judgment of the liege in order for justice to be satisfied. While a fair hearing could be expected in front of Sire Kay, this sort of thing was best done by the mage lord, I knew. It was one of the thousands of things expected of the seated nobility. It was a hallmark of good leadership, I had learned in my brief tenure as a landed nobleman. If you wanted your people to be loyal in times of crisis, they needed to see you be judicial during times of peace. Most of the mundane issues of the valley I ruled were handled locally, by the manorial courts. But now that my rule extended beyond, thanks to 5 domains I'd unexpectedly acquired last summer, I had to oversee the law and policy in each of their lands. It was not a task I could trust to many others. When it comes to managing your domain, setting policy is something you want to give your personal attention, because you have to live with the result. A law brother hired for his judgment can just shrug and walk away, leaving you with a monk's mess of problems. There were other considerations. If I didn't regularly maintain the docket, it would soon overwhelm me in bureaucracy, I also knew. Problems at that level never seemed to go away. I sat on the bench in the Great Hall that morning and heard one case after another. The hall was crowded with plaintiffs, defendants, witnesses, bailiffs, curious onlookers and interested parties. That was in addition to the regular business of the castle, which had to continue, despite the occasion, so the Great Hall was a busy place. Perhaps I invested too much of my attention to it. I know most other lords sit at court and dispense arbitrary judgment, when they pay attention to the cases at all. I was still new at this, and the novelty of my word having the power to change people's lives had not yet worn off. Thankfully, most of the cases before me required relatively simple decisions, but I still had to sit and hear each side before making a judgment. It was tedious work, and before mid-morning my back ached and my ass was complaining, making me pause to reflect on power, boredom, and the soreness of my buttocks. But its importance compelled me to give it as much attention as I could manage. I sat in my warm hall and called forth those who would have my judgment and patiently listened to their complicated issues. Then I would make a decision and they would leave. I liked to think that they left the better off for that judgment, but that wasn't always the case. Hence the presence of armed guards at the doors and on either side of my bench, just to keep things peaceful. Things had gone smoothly all morning, with my castle bailiff, Sir Staldin, a landless knight serving in the stead of his lord, efficiently ordering the cases, cracking jokes, and keeping things moving along. It wasn't a terribly tangled docket either. There were a few boundary disputes between manors, some contract disputes, and requests for boons and relief. I was generous with those, as the little war we had here last year had caused plenty of hardship among the local folk. Suffering peasants were unproductive peasants, and I had the money. Money wasn't the problem. People were the problem. Thankfully, this was my last case in the docket. "Master Gilith, representing the Weavers' Guild of Sindaria Town," Staldin began, his voice clearly starting to get tired. "Praise the Mage Lord, attend his claim for 30 sacks of wool from Vanrore Manor, the Mage Lord's domain of Carandal, held in trust by Fiston Abbey, represented by Wool Brother Tyr, Assistant Abbot of the Temple. The Honourable Master claims a promise of said wool was guaranteed by Lord Gimble. The Abbot claims that the wool was to be purchased by Sire Gimble at a discount from his own purse and delivered to the guild, but Master Gilith insists that no such arrangement was listed in his terms," Sir Staldin droned on. I sighed. There would be years of this, I knew. Feudal economies thrive on such complex arrangements, and they can get quite complicated. Sometimes the deals can span generations. When there has been a change in administration, everyone gets in a hurry to clear their outstanding accounts before they are forgotten or disavowed. Gimble had done his share of making promises and opening contracts with the guilds of Sindaria Town, the largest trade town in this region of the Bontal Riverlands. They were as convoluted as any domain's affairs, and untangling the threads of the mess had taken up the greater part of my last 2 courts. The abbey was the 3rd largest ecclesiastical territory in my new lands. The Wool Brothers of Fiston Abbey were a hard-working contemplative order, devoted to the Sky God, or Vartas. The ram was his sacred animal, presumably because the white sheep so resembled his sacred clouds, and most of their minor temples raised sheep as a homage to their divine lord.
Sometimes these were token herds, but Fiston Abbey had taken to sheep-rearing with a passion, and Ovata's devotion had led to a profitable side business in wool. So much so that the monks were referred to as Wool Brothers, not Sky Brothers, as was popular in the more urban temples. The wool of Fiston Abbey was famed for its softness and durability, and the monks could demand a premium price for it. They ran a temple house for the blind on the abbey's grounds with the proceeds of the enterprise, employing the sightless at carding and washing the famed wool. Wool Brother Tyr was no stupid shepherd, however. He carried himself like a law brother, his sheepskin hood thrown back to reveal a gleaming tonsure that added several years to his age. There were books and a roll of parchments in his sack, I saw with a sinking heart. Preparations for a lengthy argument were not a good sign. Master Gilith, on the other hand, was a portly merchant whose fat fingers had not touched a loom in memory, from what I could see. He had roomy eyes and a large nose, and despite his presence at court, with gold at stake, he appeared bored and inattentive. Until I called upon him, that is. "Master Gilith, you understand that there has been a change in administration in Carindal?" I asked for the 20th time that morning.
"Aye, Mage Lord," the merchant agreed, heavily but attentively. "It's played hob with our deliveries."
"It inconvenienced us all, I assure you," I replied dryly. "You understand that I do not feel bound by my predecessor's bargains."
"Aye, Mage Lord," the man began expectantly, "but the contract exists impartial to the arrangements made between Manor Lord, in this case the worshipful Brothers of Fiston Abbey.
Yet the purpose of the contract, to outfit the garrison in Carindal, cannot be fulfilled, as there is no garrison at Carindal any more."
"Which is why we stand before you today, Mage Lord," agreed Wool Brother Tyr, after clearing his throat. "The stated purpose in the contract was for the wool to be put toward the abbey's scutage fees for military service. When the garrison marched away, so did the bodies those clothes were for."
I'll accept the delivery of the cloth myself," I said, shearing through the legal arguments ahead with some inspired judgment. "Or at least that's what I thought."
"What?"
asked Master Gilith and Wool Brother Tyr in unison. "I'll take that wool. That cloth, I mean. I have my own garrison to clothe, and I've been looking for a source of good woolens. My lady wife despairs of clothing all the men under my banner now. The problem is solved."
"Yet, Mage Lord," the monk began, holding up a hand,
"the contract stipulates that the fee is to go in part towards scutage." "To support a garrison that no longer exists?" I asked.
"Aye. Yes, Mage Lord," the monk said, startled.
"I'll accept the wool as part of your domain's tribute this year, then," I promised. The scribe, a gnarled little man named Dariskir, scribbled the terms onto a leaf of parchment.
"Yet, Mage Lord," the monk continued, "our tribute is levied in coin, and losing the coin we would get at market for the wool we originally owed as scutage would put the abbey in a perilous way. It hardly seems fair that we be penalized for such an abrupt and sudden change in administration. The wool we lose would be thrice the fee we pay our lord."
"Then I'll... Look, what is it you want, Wool Brother Tyr?" I asked, confused. Dariskir stopped writing and looked up.
"Mage Lord, only what is fair. If there is no garrison to pay for, then we should be getting coin or fair trade for the transaction. If the Mage Lord is willing to accept delivery for his own purposes, then he should either assign scutage fees to support the garrison and properly assess the needs fairly, or allow us to profit from the trade. Although I swear the war bird's fees were far in excess of what a fair man would deem proper support." The monk eyed the merchant accusingly.
"I have no say in such matters of my betters, Mage Lord," the weaver said, shaking his head. "I sold the cloth on this contract, and—"
"Brother Tyr, how much for that wool? A fair price?" I interrupted.
"60 ounces of silver a sack on the Sindaria market."
That was a little generous, I'd figure. More like 45. But then this was the famous Fiston Abbey wool, and I wanted this case to be over so I could get up and stretch my legs.
I'll pay that out of a draft to my account with the Sindaria Temple of Ifnia, collect the wool and have it delivered, then pay a fair price. A fair price, Master Weaver, I reiterated, for the cloth to be woven, fulled, and dyed. 7-door green, and then I want it delivered to this very castle before the first moon of autumn. If you can do it before, I'll pay a 10% premium. But this contract before me is henceforth cancelled. Is that understood? Neither party wanted to argue. I'd just handed them both a handsome profit. Perhaps not the most responsible use of resources, but we could use the wool, and I had the money. I'd pay twice the difference just to not have to hear any argument concerning sheep, wool, or cloth. "Call a recess," I ordered the bailiff, tiredly. "I've had enough justice today. I'll have lunch in my workshop, please," I told my page. Teres was the 10-year-old son of a knight in Carandar, who had asked for the lad to be fostered at Sevendor for a year, and trained for service, before he was squired out. I liked the boy. I was surprised how well he had stood up to the mind-numbing boredom of court. Surprised and pleased. He was smart, and was almost starting to know when to keep his mouth shut. He could even be useful if my cup needed filling, or I had a message to send. He could handle a simple lunch order, for instance.
"Are you going to cast spells, Mage Lord?"
the boy asked in a hushed tone, as he stood and stretched. He'd only been here since Yule, and apart from mage lights, had seen little active magic yet. I'm sure he thought I was doing magic all the time in my private chambers. "No, Teres," I whispered back, "I'm going to play with marvels." There were 136 high magi in the kingdom of Castelshar. 18 had been given witch stones from the beginning, 17 rough-and-tumble war magi, and one ambitious researcher in sex magic, during the siege of Bovol Castle. Since then, I had administered the oath to an additional 116, as stones were captured and cleansed from the goblin armies who were invading the kingdom from the northwest. Some had been given as bribes, some as tools, some as enticements, and a few as rewards. Most had been granted to war magi who were willing to take up the fight against Shirul, the dead god, the undead floating goblin head who led the invaders. The witch stones were what made a man, or woman, a high mage. Common human magi draw their power from carefully cultivated sources, natural forces, and their own personal ability to draw arcane power from the magosphere. With a psychic attachment to a witch stone, Irionite, to the lore masters, the power a mage had access to was increased by orders of magnitude. It was the difference between sipping wine through a reed straw and guzzling it directly from a hogshead. Irionite was a type of green amber that could form naturally in some mountainous places, but the goblins had discovered the process and put the head of their last great shaman within a sphere of it, after his execution. Most of the Irionite I'd granted was captured shards that had been broken off that sphere. There were hundreds of them in the hands of Shirul's shamans, and while they were effective, they weren't particularly adept at using that power efficiently. Not as efficiently as imperially trained war magi. So we took them away from them and used them ourselves. The human forces had done a good job of harvesting witch stones from our foes since the opening days of the war. But they couldn't be used by a human mage until they were cleansed of the dead god's influence, else the user would theoretically become corrupted. Unfortunately, every stone from Shirul's head was still thaumaturgically connected to him. The Alka Alon, known commonly as the Tree Folk, had assisted us by giving me a way to break the connection. They were the masters of magic on Kalador, and the dead god's minions didn't like them any more than they liked us Humani. A stone could be used only by being in proximity to my stone, which was now the size of a man's fist, for a while. Otherwise, the dead god could slowly overcome your mind and take control of you. A few of the stones I had taken more than one oath over. As war magi died at the front, and their stones were recovered, I'd reused them on new victims. I'd done that over a dozen times now. My former occupation has a high mortality rate. While it was depressing, there was no end to the volunteers who wished to replace the fallen. Irionite is that powerful. To a mage invested in his craft, the allure of that kind of power is irresistible. And in comparison to, say, temporal power,
It beats the hell out of dispensing petty justice to merchants and monks. After court adjourned, I took my luncheon in my workshop with my wife, my dog Midnight, deciding to join us. She had grown significantly since I'd acquired her at Yule. My dog, not my wife, but she still had a puppy's insecurity. I let her tag along with us at lunch, which I was also looking forward to. I was going to be gone a lot soon, and I figured she deserved as much of my attention as I could give her before I left. My wife, not my dog. Alia rarely came up to my workshop, but when she did, she sat in a cunningly woven wicker chair that was eternally reserved for her, a war prize retrieved from the sunny hills of Gilmora. A few minutes after Teres delivered a basket of ham, eggs, bread and cheese from the kitchen with a bottle of cider, my lady wife settled into the creaking, oversized monstrosity after kissing me hello. She smelled of breast milk and lavender. Her belly was continuing to grow daily. "What's that?" she asked, eyeing the board I was toying with. She was hesitant to ask, I knew, but she was always curious about my work. I didn't mind the curiosity. I admired it. Her ignorance of my craft required a lot of remedial explanation, but I had come to value the lessons in explaining arcane concepts to a layman, as I taught my apprentices and tried to overcome the challenges of doing magic in a rural, drafty old castle. I picked up a greenstone and showed it to her. "That's Irionite." "Not really," I corrected. "That's just a representation of a piece of Irionite. A piece I've taken someone's oath over." "There are," I continued, gesturing toward the board on the table, 136 high magi in the kingdom, or just outside of it. "This is what I'm going to use to keep track of them," I said, gesturing grandly at the board. "Magically?" "Conceptually," I admitted. "I got the idea from a creepy old lady who kills people and keeps records of it. I could try to do it magically, and perhaps someday I will. But right now it's more important that I have an accurate system of representation for them than a nifty new spell. Each of these marbles represents one witch stone in play, and there are plenty more to come. Just how many will depend upon the generosity of the Alka Alon, but I'm going to have more high magi to regulate in the future, not less." The nearly immortal non-humans who knew the secret of making Irionite were reclusive, living mostly in elaborate tree houses or quaint little mystical groves, far from human habitations. But their lords tended to live in sophisticated arboreal cities, inside dense woodlands, or in stately stone and wood settlements in remote and hidden locations, selected for their magnificence and beauty, not their proximity to good grain lands. Their very greatest lords lived in fabulous cities built underground, or in hidden valleys, or in great towers of surpassing elegance among remote peaks built millennia ago during their race's ascendancy. Those were the Alka Alon to whom the white stone of which my castle and the surrounding mountains was of such interest, not the rustic, arboreal sort. Snowstone was unique and interesting to the immortal masters of magic, and to their long-lived race unique was intriguing. I had let it be known to their emissaries that I would be willing to trade some quantity for it, if the payment was made in Irionite. The Alka Alon lords did not trade the way humans do. They give each other gifts. But Irionite was a gift we sorely needed to fight the war with Shirul and have any hope of success, and the Alka Alon were the only ones beside Shirul who had a supply. "So how do you tell them apart?" "Magic?" "I had their names painted on them. Dara did it. She has a neat hand with a brush. But no magic. Excepting that everything she does is part of her overall magical training, no. I can't spell my way out of this mess. This is a bureaucratic problem, not an arcane one. I have to know where these people are, who they are, and what they are doing if I'm going to police them properly. So, each one of these marbles corresponds to a scroll in my archives detailing each high mage." "What about the blue marbles?" she asked curiously, as she broke off a crust of bread. "Those are powerful low magi who either have potential to be raised or who might want to oppose the new order. The yellow stand for specialist magi who the order wants to recruit. The red stand for the low magi of the censorate.
What about the pretty black ones? Those are hematite. They represent the human magi who have gone to work